Translation in purport by His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada. With sword in hand, intelligent men cut through the binding knots of reactionary work, karma, by remembering the personality of Godhead. Therefore, who will not pay attention to His message? Purport. The contact of the spiritual spark with material elements creates a knot which must be cut if one wants to be liberated from the actions and reactions of fruitive work. Liberation means freedom from the cycle of reactionary work. This liberation automatically follows for one who constantly remembers the transcendental pastimes of the personality of Godhead. This is because all the activities of the Supreme Lord, His Leela, are transcendental to the modes of the material energy. They are all attractive spiritual activities, and therefore constant association with the spiritual activities of the Supreme Lord gradually spiritualizes the conditioned soul and ultimately severs the knot of material bondage. Liberation from material bondage is, therefore, a byproduct of devotional service. Attainment of spiritual knowledge is not sufficient to ensure liberation. Such knowledge must be overcoated with devotional service, so that ultimately the devotional service alone predominates. Then liberation is made possible. Even the reactionary work of the fruitive workers can lead one to liberation when it is overcoated with devotional service. Karma overcoated with devotional service is called karma yoga. Similarly, empirical knowledge overcoated with devotional service is called jnana yoga. But pure bhakti yoga is independent of such karma and jnana because it alone can not only endow one with liberation from conditional life, but also award one the transcendental loving service of the Lord. Therefore, any sensible man who is above the average man with a poor fund of knowledge must constantly remember the personality of Godhead by hearing about Him, by glorifying Him, by remembering Him, and by worshiping Him always without cessation. That is the perfect way of devotional service. The Goswamis of Vrindavan, who were authorized by Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu to preach the bhakti cult, rigidly followed this rule and made immense literatures of transcendental science for our benefit. They have chalked out ways for all classes of men in terms of the different castes and orders of life in pursuance of the teachings of Srimad Bhagavatam and similar other authoritative scriptures. Karma grunti, nibandhanam. We're tied up by this, all of us, tied up by this knot of fruitive work. It's a knot of misery, of frustration. So many anxieties, the bad weather, your bad digestion, having to study this horrible grammar and your teacher is threatening you with tests. So many anxieties, even in brahmachari life. Let us speak then of the materialists, how much they are suffering. Don't go back to that life. Don't go back to that material life. It is full of all these anxieties. The heart becomes bound up in knots of anxiety. We're suffering a little bit, and we have sad looks on our faces for a little bit of anxiety. What to speak then of those who really are tied up in this misery? So Baba says the man who is better than the average man who has a poor fund of knowledge, the one who's a little more intelligent, he wants to take to this devotional service. person with half a brain wants to become liberated. He's got it half right. You know, he wants to negate the suffering. But he doesn't know what to replace it with. He doesn't have a proper idea of happiness. He just knows to cure the disease. It's like the psychiatry of modern times. They decide everybody's crazy, or almost everybody, and we should make them normal. We should take their brains and straighten them out. You know, they're called shrinks. They take your brain and shrink it. So psychiatry has the idea, yes, we have to restore normal mental health. But not one of those psychiatrists has a clear idea of what a normal mental condition is. What a healthy, mental, happy condition is. What is happiness? Sigmund Freud, because he was frustrated in his sex urge, he thought was unrestricted sex. Sex with your mother, anybody. That's freedom and happiness. That's liberation. To give up your guilt about wanting to have sex with your mother. You know, not a clear concept of what happiness is. Sigmund Freud didn't live a happy life and he didn't die a happy death. He was a very addicted cigar smoker. And when he was getting a little old, he developed cancer of the mouth. They had to cut his mouth away. He couldn't, you know, they put an artificial mouth on him. It was very painful. He died in frustration and pain just because he was addicted to sucking on cigars. These people don't have a clear idea of what is happiness. Neither do the impersonalists. They just know how to negate, how 1980 to negativize everything, to try to reduce to zero. But there's no happiness in zero either. Yenye adavindaksha vimuktamaninas. They think this is liberation, freedom. Vimuktamani. They presume they become liberated because they've given up external attachments. But their hearts are still bound by the knot of envy, lust, and greed, even though they're not expressing it. Express, outward. But inside, it's still knotted up. Tvayastabhavad avishuddha buddhayaha. Their intelligence has not become clean. Tvayastabhavad, for a good reason. Because they haven't done any devotional service. They have no devotion. Devotion is required for liberation. You may think this is circular reasoning. You need devotion for liberation, and you need liberation for devotion. But there's different levels. You need a rudimentary devotion, some trace of devotion. Just like, you know, the khichdi should have some salt in it. No, not five cups, but if you put no salt in the khichdi, then it's very austere. Then it's, you know, what the yogis eat, but they don't like it. Yeah. No salt, some salt at least. So you need a little bit of devotion to spice up your endeavor for liberation. Otherwise, it doesn't get off the ground. You cannot actually approach liberation. You can't give up material things if you're not experiencing some happiness. Padam drishna nivartate. You have to get a higher taste to be able to give up your addictions to cigars or whatever. You're going to be miserable trying to pursue material happiness unless you can replace it with some spiritual happiness. And the only place you'll find real spiritual happiness is on the path of bhakti. There's no pleasure in becoming zero. Any more than it's pleasurable to sit in the hospital with all your body tied up in ropes because you broke all your bones in a car accident. You're getting well, that's true. They're doing a good job of curing you, but you're tied up in this contraption. You can't even move. And you try to put on a good face when your friends come in and ask you, how are you doing? Well, I'm doing fine. You know, I'm really happy here. But there's no happiness being locked up in the hospital, having them come and prick you every hour and make you do so many things you don't want to do. Happiness when you get out of the hospital. But the Impersonalists are like someone who's also in that accident suffered amnesia. He doesn't remember where he's supposed to go when he gets out. He doesn't remember who he is and where his home is. So he'll have to stay in the hospital. He has no place else to go. The impersonalists are like that. Just become zero, and there's no positive spiritual life. So Suta Goswami is setting everything straight here. Yes, the knot has to be severed, the knot of material anxiety. You can't be happy full of material anxieties. They should be cut through, but it's cut. Not that you have to sit down and try to unravel it, pull it apart knot by knot. There's thousands of knots, and you're going to sit there and untwirl each knot. And they're knots upon knots, and knots tied to knots. It will take you forever, and it will drive you crazy. So, chindanti. This is what's called in Greek literature the Gordian knot. That there was this, someone made a really complicated knot, knots on knots on knots, heavy rope, and offered a prize, I don't know, his daughter or something, to whoever, or maybe it was, if you can't do it, I'll kill you. Anyway, there was a contest. You have to try to unravel the knot. And many tried and couldn't do it. So this hero, Gordian, who was also smart, he was confronted with this challenge, and he simply took out his sword and sliced it. Cut it all apart with his sword. Chindanti. So the word is being used here by Suta Goswami. I don't think he read Greek literature, but this is where it originally comes from the Bhagavatam. They cut through the knot. Asina, with a sword. But what does the sword consist of? Vaishnavas, at least in our line, don't usually carry swords with them. Maybe some other. There are some military lines of Vaishnavism, and they go out looking for fights with the Shaivites. But that's not our line. We don't carry swords usually. Even in remembrance of Lord Vishnu's sword, that's not our business. But we have metaphysical sword. Yad anu dhya. Usually the word is dhyanam, with an extra syllable, suffix. But this is a different suffix, just dhya, anu dhya, remembrance. And of course it means anu, constant and following the standard authorities, not whimsical, imagined remembrance, but real remembrance and constant remembrance. It's not good enough just to remember Krishna once a week. You have to remember him every day and all day. That's anudhya. Krishna consciousness is not a part-time activity. Because if you spend most of your time consorting with Maya, you won't be fit for your 5 or 10 minutes of Krishna consciousness. It won't amount to anything. You have to be Krishna consciousness most or all of the time. Otherwise, it's not effective. Anudhya, constant remembrance. That's the sword. It cuts right through all those knots of anxiety and worries. It does. We must have experienced it sometimes. We're not so good at anudhya, but we do some partial dhya. Once in a while we remember Krishna, and we see that it does cut through the knots. What is big if we can remember all the time? If we can become really Krishna conscious, which doesn't mean, you know, to do 3 parikramas every day and get Radharani's darshana. That's not Krishna consciousness. That's not what we're talking about. I'm not saying it's not Krishna conscious, but that's not the key. The key is anudhya, constant remembrance, not just some spectacular vision once in your life. What are you going to do with that? You can get Radha and Krishna can come and show themselves to you. What are you going to do with them? You'll be the same person after you see them, just like Daksha Prajapati was when he saw Vishnu. He got his darshan, but he didn't know what to do with it. So what we need is constant remembrance, even if it's simple remembrance, nothing spectacular, but constant. Be Krishna conscious all the time. Like, you know, I'm Krishna's servant. I'm here washing the pots, sweeping the floor, studying sutras. I'm doing it for Krishna's pleasure. This is my service to Prabhupada. That makes it transcendental. My studying Sanskrit grammar is for the service of Prabhupada. And if you're not thinking that, then your study of Sanskrit is useless. And Prabhupada doesn't like it. You can read all the statements from Prabhupada. There are hundreds of Sanskrit scholars in the world. This was in reply to devotees suggesting, why don't we train up the devotees in Sanskrit? I presume that was the question asked. Something like that. And Prabhupada's answer that's recorded in the folio is that there are hundreds of Sanskrit scholars in the world already. And they're all useless. So, if we don't constantly remember that our study of this Sanskrit grammar is for the service of Prabhupada's mission, somehow was supposed to be used for Prabhupada's mission. If we don't remember that all the time, we'll dissatisfy Prabhupada. We'll be in the category of the useless Sanskrit scholars, even if we become masters. Danger is there. Anudya, constant remembrance, constant Krishna consciousness. It doesn't have to be spectacular, you know, stun the whole world with the virtuosity of your Krishna consciousness. Just ordinary remembering Krishna and Krishna's service, but doing it all the time, steadily. The steadiness is the quality that's important. Not that it impresses anybody. Krishna is impressed by the steadiness. So those devotees who are equipped with this sword and use it, they can cut through the knot, right through the knots of material attachments and anxieties. And they can sit here with a smile on their faces, even in the middle of the winter, even the day before the exam. So, ko na kuryat katarucim, vatim. Who is it who would not want to develop loving attraction to Krishna Katha? You may want to dance with Krishna. You may want to have lunch with Krishna. You may want to get benedictions from Krishna. You may want an opportunity to fan him. You may have some secret desire. But that's later on. When you've actually developed your prema and your relationship with Krishna, you can think about those things. The basic desire should be the desire to become attracted to hearing and chanting about Krishna. That's available to us now. The other things are available later on. But to get near being qualified for the intimate devotional service, we have to practice this Shravanam Kirtanam service. This is the foundation. It always is and it always was. It's not just for Kali Yuga. The foundation of devotional service is Shravanam Kirtanam, and then the Smaranam. But first of all the Shravanam, then the Kirtanam. These two activities are the basis of all devotional service to Krishna. And in order to be able to do Shravanam and Kirtanam with any good effect, you have to have some attraction. Taste for it. If you don't like it, you won't be able to do it. Even if we pay you for it. We can pay you per the round. But you won't want to do it. You'd rather do something else, even a lower salary. It's for those who have no taste, it's impossible to hear and chant about Krishna. So it's a rhetorical, it's a question. Therefore, who will not pay attention to the messenger? Who will not have attraction to hearing about Krishna? And as it was mentioned a few days ago, the answer is there at the beginning of the 10th canto. There's one place where the answer is given, in Parikshit's words. Ka uttama shloka gunanu vadat puman virajyeta vina pashugunat. So who? He asks the question again, but then he gives a qualification and begins to give the answer. Who would not hear the narrations, Anuvada, about the qualities of Uttama Shloka, Krishna, the personality of Godhead? Vina Pashugna, except for someone who was Pashugna. What's the difference between Pashugna and Pashuha? Same thing? Same idea? Killer of Pashu. Pashu is a domestic animal. There's Mrigas and Pashus. Mrigas are wild animals. So if a wild tiger is coming to the village, you have to kill him. He can eat your babies and kill your chickens. So a tiger in the village is dangerous and he has to be killed. Wild animal. But the animals, the chickens, and your babies, these are pashus. These are innocent animals. These are domesticated animals. They're meant to be protected. So, okay, if you kill a tiger who invades the village, nothing wrong in that. Or you kill a snake or a scorpion. Sadhurdeva samodavya. Sarva vishtika hatyaya. A sadhu is pleased when a scorpion or a snake or a wild tiger invading the village is killed. But you don't go around killing the chickens and the dogs in the village. The pigs, that's low-class behavior. Pashugna, someone who kills domesticated animals. Doesn't even mention the cows. That's horrible to think of, killing cows. But to kill any domesticated animal who is depending on us for protection. This is really the lowest category of human being, the Pashugna. The killer of innocent, dependent creatures, dependent on you. Trusts you, and you kill him. So that's the literal meaning of Pashugna, but actually it can be expanded. There are extended meanings of Pashugna. Lord Shiva is called Pashupati, and all the bewildered souls are called Pashus. This is Shaiva Siddhanta philosophy. The Pashus, where the Jivas are Pashus. Pashu doesn't just mean animal, it means any living being, any finite soul. And Lord Mahadev is the Pashupati, the lord of all the Pashus. So killing souls, that's another level of abomination. It's even worse than killing actual animals, killing the soul. How do you kill souls? You can't, Krishna said in the Gita, you can't kill the soul. You can't even damage him. You can't even get him wet. So how do you kill a soul? The phrase is there. It means you ruin a person's opportunity for ever becoming liberated, from ever having any real spiritual life. How can you do that? There are various ways. Prominently two ways. Intoxication destroys the subtle body and kills your opportunity for real spiritual life. Some of us survived intoxication and became ISKCON devotees anyway. But it didn't make things easier. Prabhupada picked up the hippies who were all drug addicts, not all of them, but more or less drug addicts. I don't know your generation, maybe you're clean, but we weren't. And it doesn't make it easier to practice Krishna consciousness, to have these holes in your brain, in your subtle body. And to someone who's seriously indulges in intoxication, he destroys the subtle body and destroys his hope for spiritual life. It's spiritual suicide. Because there's also, I skipped over literal suicide. A person who kills himself is also Pashugna, a suicide. But there's spiritual suicide by intoxication. And then the most virulent form of suicide and murder is the propagation of Mayavad philosophy, which does a very good job of ruining any opportunity of pursuing real spiritual life. One who becomes a hardcore Mayavadi and influenced by these hardcore Mayavadis, it's very, very hard to recover that person and put him on the proper spiritual path. You have to be on the level of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu to accomplish such a thing, to convert 20,000 Mayavadis. To even convert one Mayavadi takes more strength than most of us have. It's so hard. They're so lost. So that is Pashugna. The person who learns, who imbibes the poison of Mayavad philosophy, and even worse, the person who dishes it out to others. but teaches it to others. He's committing murder, spiritual murder. That's Pashugna also. These are the people who aren't attracted, don't have a taste for hearing Krishna Katha. Everybody else should. Innocent people should be attracted. Preaching is primarily directed to those innocent people. We don't, because we can preach to the congregation, we can preach to the devotees. But the people who need the preaching the most are the ones outside. We're having a nice time here preaching to ourselves. What about the people? Of course, everybody's coming to Govardhan because they're attracted to Krishna. But around the world, people are ignorant of Krishna, or even though they know something, they're ignoring Krishna. We have to wake them up, attract them, preach to them. That's a Christian word, preach. But Prabhupada used it in such a way, we understand what he meant by that. To attract them to hear about Krishna. It's hard to save those who are already Pashugnas, but those who haven't yet fallen prey to the Pashugnas and become Pashugna, they should be attracted to hearing about Krishna. Ko na kuryat kataratim. So this was spoken by Sutta to an assembly of sages who already had Ruti, but they were speaking for the benefit of us and the people outside who should be able to develop their attraction to hearing about Krishna. But if we're just sitting in here and to take care of ourselves and don't go out to help the others, then we're misers. And I don't mean we should drop our studies and run out with book bags. I mean we should pursue our studies with the intention of giving Krishna consciousness to others. Maybe we're postponing it for 2-3 years. But when we go get out of here, we should use our knowledge to save the world. Otherwise, we're misers. Okay, so any questions or comments? Yes, sir. Practice? Do you have an answer? You're getting into it, okay. Yeah, could you speak it loud? Oh, I'll repeat it. No, I forgot the question. Say it again. Well, okay, we can do it collectively. We can sit down and have a program together. But we each have to work on it individually. Developing our taste for hearing and chanting. It comes by practice. If you do it, how do you get a taste for... I never had cauliflower until I went to university. My mother never cooked cauliflower, never bought it. And I thought it was weird. Yeah, because the cafeteria in the school, they just served it plain, nothing on it. When I came to ISKCON, then I found out what cauliflower can be. So I developed a taste by tasting it, by practice. Maybe the first couple of times I didn't like it. But after the practice, I got used to the taste. You develop a taste by practice. So the thing we have to do is get a chance and take advantage of it to practice hearing and chanting about Krishna. Sit down and hear. Pick up your beads and chant. Go out and recite to somebody else what you heard. Practice. Then the taste develops. Okay. Because it's tasteful, it's tasty. So you just have to practice tasting it. That's all. Yes. Well, okay. What's the definition of a... How do you tell who's a senior or a younger devotee? Well, one way. There may be various ways to measure. Various symptoms of an advanced devotee. But one of them is, and the thing is, some of the symptoms are internal and you can't see them. So you can't use them as practical measurements looking at somebody else. Some of them you can look at yourself inside and see. But you want an easy way to measure someone from the outside who's advanced. I would say two things that are basic. How much he's attracted to hearing and chanting about Krishna. When he sits down to give a Bhagavatam class, does he talk about Krishna or does he talk about himself? You know, is he actually attracted to hearing and chanting about Krishna? What do you see him doing? Is he talking gossip and complaining about other people, or is he talking about Krishna or something connected to Krishna? So one good sign is how a person's attracted to Krishna, hearing and chanting about him. The other one is, negative side of it, how he's not attracted to all material topics. But that goes together. It's just the other side of the same thing. May not be the only way to measure, but I think that's a very good way to measure, and it's something practical you can see in other people. You see when they open their mouth, what do they talk about? You can't really tell what they're thinking inside. We don't have X-ray vision to see inside a person's brain. But we can hear what he's saying when he opens his mouth. Okay? An advanced devotee should be one who talks about Krishna and wants to hear about Krishna. Okay? Yes, Bart, remember? Or ruins his own opportunity, his own or somebody else's. Okay, maybe I should repeat that for those who couldn't hear without the microphone. I'll just summarize it. That, you know, Pashugna means rooting someone else's opportunity to become Krishna conscious. We in our immaturity in the beginning, may have done that. And you cited the example of you think you discouraged your parents by the way you treated them rudely. Well, that's a danger. Neophyte can do damage. You know, by acting foolishly, he could discourage somebody from Krishna consciousness, someone near to him even. Therefore, new devotees should be kept under protection. They shouldn't be running around too much. Maybe they shouldn't be hanging around with their parents too much because they'll just discourage them. You know, they'll just put, you know, they don't know how to, as neophytes, how to properly act with their parents. Maybe better they stay in the ashram for a while and go visit their parents after a month or two. There should be some basic training. And how to deal with people, how to deal with your own parents before you're unleashed to discourage them. You know, when I joined in America, you could go visit your parents once a month maybe, you know, for a few hours because, if it wasn't good for you, they could influence you and you might not impress them very much. Okay? Yes, okay, what are the best ways we can use the knowledge we're getting here for preaching? Well, we have to consider what Prabhupada's mission in ISKCON consists of and how we can contribute to it. We have the Bhaktivedanta Book Trust who's paying the bills here. And the Bhaktivedanta Book Trust wants people who can produce new books. Translations of the literature of our Sampradaya and the Vedic literature. Translations and commentaries. BBT is not interested in publishing serious books without commentaries. Translation is not enough. So we need people who can do that. Present the translations and commentaries of a lot of literature that's been, maybe a lot of it's been published, but not published well. We want to do it over again, properly. Do justice to the authors. So for that, we need translators, commentators, and editors to That's the, one of the first purposes of this school, is to train up the translators and editors. And we had, you know, they have to also, the translator also has to write a commentary. That's a big job. You got to be very qualified. You won't be qualified after just 3 years. This is just the undergraduate course. 5 to 7 years at least to get trained up as a translator, even if you're really good. It took me 25 years. And then beside that, maybe some devotees around the world also want to learn some Sanskrit, so we need to provide teachers for Gurukulas and maybe other programs. Maybe we expand branches around the different places in the world. We need to train up staff, teachers, to teach others in the Gurukulas and in our own, if we expand into branches. And then the GBC, they're depending on having some learned brahmanas who can read the commentaries in the shastras and answer philosophical questions. We need researchers for ISKCON who can answer tough questions that require looking into the old books. That's maybe not a full-time job, but that's another thing to do. Now, those who are doing BBT work and teaching can also do this. They can do research for ISKCON. And explain the shastras. And in general, devotees need learned, then we need learned devotees around the world who can present the Bhagavatam in a very authoritative way. Who can read the original commentaries and explain the book properly in a very, you know, spiritually scholarly level. Not the way they do at the university, picking everything apart and trying to destroy faith, but to create faith by showing that this is the real thing and is substantiated by the commentaries. And it's all coherent, and it all questions are answered. So we need expert devotees just to sit down and give a Bhagavatam class anywhere in the world. Even if nothing else, even if you don't do anything else with it, if you can go and give Bhagavatam classes around, you know, anywhere in the world on a very authoritative level, that's an accomplishment. I would say the 3 years are worth it just for that. Because by giving Bhagavatam classes, by propagating the Bhagavatam, that's what's going to change the world. Prabhupada wanted book distribution not just to collect money so he can build buildings. He wanted to propagate the Bhagavatam. But if it can be done expertly, that's better. So we want to train up expert Bhagavatam preachers. Even if you don't make a career out of it, you know, get an official position with the BBT or with a Gurukula, even if you just go and give Bhagavatam classes. Remain a brahmachari. You won't need to earn money anyway if you just stay a brahmachari. Yes. Yes. Yeah, it is. It's like not first. It's something that's only necessary. Let me repeat that. That there are devotees out there who've strayed away from Prabhupada's teachings and are preaching some sort of various versions of nonsense or things that are deviant in various ways to various extents. And some of them know Sanskrit and can quote Shastra and explain it. So because of opposition who knows Sanskrit, therefore the defenders have to know Sanskrit to meet the opposition. That's secondary in the sense that if the opposition wasn't there, we wouldn't need that. We don't need to answer doubts if nobody raises them, but they are being raised.
I would say that even without the opposition being around, we still need to show what
I don't know. If suppose everyone took it very seriously that we shouldn't read other books, and nobody in ISKCON ever picked up a book other than Prabhupada's. Just imagine, suppose that, just like when Prabhupada was around, he didn't encourage reading so many other books. And suppose for the next 30, 50,000 years, we took that very seriously, and nobody started reading all of these. Pandora box never got opened. Suppose this Pandora's box never got opened, of reading everything, no matter who translated it or what. We want all the nectar. Suppose we were very scared about that and never read, none of us ever read anything but Prabhupada's books. Then there wouldn't be any need for that defending the opposition, against the opposition. There wouldn't be any. If nobody read anything but Prabhupada's books, we'd be safe. And we'd have all the knowledge we need. But we had to make things complicated by opening up the box and, and sticking our nose in all these other books. But it's already happened. You can't undo it. You can't stuff it back in the box. Yes. Anyway, it can minimize problems. Even the other books are okay. You got too many other books, then Prabhupada's books become minimized. Yes. Okay. So we'll stop here. Thank you. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai.